and independent artists.
Coming up in a minute on the second half of Humankind, we explore moral injury when soldiers commit wartime acts that violate their conscience. Also, soldiers and theologians wrestle with the age-old question of why God permits suffering, even the severe damage people undergo from military violence. When Humankind continues in a moment.
What up, Bill Detroit? I'm Senior Chief Deontay Wade, United States Navy, supporting American diplomacy at the U.S. Embassy in Singapore. I would like to thank all the veterans in Detroit and across America. We salute you, thank you for your service, and defend your freedom around the world. Stay safe, and God bless.
This Humankind special project, The Power of Nonviolence, is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by a major grant from the Henry Luce Foundation.
The cumulative effect of what I did and saw, it's not that it was just brutal and everyday gore and hell, but the stress over time wears you down.
How military veterans can begin to heal from the invisible wounds and lasting trauma of participating in war. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. How does a person recover after witnessing the brutality of war? And when soldiers are drawn in as a participant in the violence, how can they heal? Warfare can leave someone deeply rattled, inflicting emotional damage, not just visible injuries. And these psychological wounds may not surface till months or years after a veteran returns from combat.
This is why, you know, so many vets get in trouble driving, because you drive defensively. You're not obeying any traffic laws. You're literally driving to save your life. And the way you drive over there is to avoid an ambush or a vehicle-borne, you know, explosive or everything. You just blow through everything.
Travis Weiner served two tours with the U.S. Army in Iraq, ending in 2008.
And the one thing that's left over from this day to me is if I'm driving and something is on the road that doesn't necessarily belong there, like a, you know, piece of trash, or my eyes just lock onto it. It's a subconscious thing. It's just boom, I just see it clearer than day, because that can be the difference between, you know, life or death.
It's a fear response. It's anybody can have it. You can get it from a natural disaster, a car accident, being raped. Your terror system is on high alert, and your fear system takes over.
Rita Nakashima Brock, a theologian based in Fort Worth, Texas. She grew up in a military family and has written widely about how people recover from military violence. An estimated 300,000 to 400,000 veterans now suffer effects like the fear response and other symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
And if that happens a lot, you can have a chronic fear response to things, that you can be triggered in normal life by things that aren't dangerous, but they were dangerous before, like a backpack sitting in a room or a guardrail along a road. You have this distorted relationship to reality that's not the fear reality you're originally in.
Reloading!
It's been well known that war induces psychological and social and spiritual trauma, and that that trauma is often invisible but devastating and requires psychological and a spiritual remedy.
Physician Wayne Jonas of the Samueli Institute in Alexandria, Virginia, served as a lieutenant colonel in the Army Medical Corps. He treats patients today who suffer military-related chronic pain, traumatic brain injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
When we diagnosed and named it PTSD. It was, in many ways, a normal response to the trauma of war. In fact, Admiral Mullen refuses to use the D on the end of that, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He calls it PTS, post-traumatic stress, because it is a normal kind of response that you would expect from those kinds of injuries, and we shouldn't make it a disorder.
Maybe it's just an understandable human reaction to the way organized violence can be deeply disturbing. Off the battlefield, some veterans may erupt in volcanic bursts of anger. Despair may draw them into addiction or violence against others and themselves. They may suffer nightmares, restless sleep, as well as what's called the startle response. This occurs when a person who's undergone a traumatic event hears or sees something that suddenly triggers a distressing memory of the trauma. Soldiers have exhibited these symptoms through history. It was first medically recognized as PTSD after the Vietnam era. Now the stresses of war have afflicted a new generation.
I'd already had combat where I lost friends. Very close friends from Iraq.
That's Kyle, originally from Maine. Starting in early 2005, he deployed to Iraq and later to Afghanistan. Kyle served as a second lieutenant with the National Guard and began experiencing post-traumatic stress.
And I came home, and that's when I didn't say a word about it, because that's when it really did have a stigma. And I said, I don't want to tell them I have something wrong. Because I don't want to get kicked out of the military. I don't want people to think I'm crazy.
Kyle has since been formally diagnosed with PTSD. He now routinely attends a clinic for at-risk veterans and their families at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Kyle participated in our interview, hoping it would help other vets. At age 35, he looks back on an eventful life so far. In this program, we'll hear graphic, sometimes disturbing descriptions of war.
Growing up and working on the farm, potato harvest in, you know, October, November can be a pretty miserable time. Cold, wet, tired, and long days, hard work. And I joined the Army, and I was like, you know, this really isn't that bad at all. And, you know, they put you to bed at a certain time every night, and every day it was something different. You got to go out and shoot guns, and I just fell in love with it. Honey lavender, green tea, American breakfast.
I visited Kyle on a Saturday afternoon at his spacious, airy home on a long wooded road in the southern New Hampshire town of Derry. For a time after returning from combat, he worked in private industry in aerospace and defense. But then Kyle accepted full-time work with the New Hampshire National Guard. He remembers his time in Afghanistan.
This was a very remote area. It was almost like the West Virginia of Afghanistan, almost. Villages, some didn't have wells. They had their own flour mill, still living in kolots and, you know, mud structures and things like that. But everybody had a cell phone.
The U.S. mission there was to stabilize the region and to control the flow of hostile forces. These included the Taliban, which stalked the American soldiers.
Terrain played a huge part. So if you're going into a valley to check, you know, the valley leads directly into Pakistan. There's one way in and then there's one way out. So they have, however long you're on the far end of the valley, they have that much time to prepare for you on the way out. Which was generally the case. You could almost set your watch on it that, you know, you go through this certain area on your way out, you're probably going to take contact and you're probably going to get ambushed. We were with the Afghan Uniform Police, which we had a very good relationship with. Their commander was one of the few that we really trusted and we worked along with, a really good guy. And this was near the time of election for local leaders. And we went into this valley and we checked to see if they were valid areas where people could go and vote. In the process of doing so, I told the police commander, Chief Wahab, I said, there's one more left. Just go up that little road right there and check and see if it's there, and then we'll call it a day and we'll head back to base. As he drove off, he didn't make it much more than a
few hundred yards away before I heard a massive explosion. And as I looked up, there was a body flying through the air like a rag doll. It's seared into my brain. You could just see it flying. At which point, they started a pretty complex ambush on us. They were firing from multiple directions. They were, from what we gathered from the intelligence afterward, they took the women and children and lowered them down into a shallow well. And they were attacking from the village, firing from the village or from the structures. And I'm running back and forth between vehicles trying to get a situation report, just kind of see what's happening. And as I went up, I saw move from vehicle to vehicle. You know, you could see the bullets hit in front of your feet and things like that. And I'm talking to my platoon sergeant and walking back and forth. And as he and I would stop and talk or just meet, we'd see bullets ricochet between us. So I moved up to the lead vehicle and I started seeing just the bodies everywhere, body parts everywhere. So it was a few different vehicles and, you know, an unarmored Ford Ranger with, you know, 8 to 10 guys either in the cab or on the back, sitting on the back, had hit an IED. Most of them were dismembered or horribly injured. You know, Chief Wahab was in the vehicle and he was medevaced out immediately. He did survive, but he was not the same after that. I saw him afterward and he was very peaked and frail. I just remember one of the guys that wasn't even in it, he wasn't injured, a younger man, and he was walking around with a machine gun, just almost dragging it, and he was stunned, crying, sobbing, and, you know, there's a machine gun with a belt of ammunition dragging on the ground in back of him, and there's bodies that were laying there that were essentially turned to jelly. I mean, just the overpressure from the bomb had shattered all their bones, and it looked like a wetsuit. As I sat there and I talked to my fire support NCO to see what I could bring for air assets, I looked down and there's a human hand at my feet. And then I looked up and I saw my interpreter. He grabbed a weapon from one of the uniformed police, and he was also carrying a human arm. So at that point, the mission became recovery of the remains. We went around and picked up body parts, and we filled 2 or 3 pickup trucks, beds, with body parts, and hauled it back.
It sounds gory, it sounds horrific. I can't imagine what that would have been like.
It's difficult to explain. As an infantryman, everybody, you know, that's what you train for and you love it, combat. And it's not like you're not aware of what you're getting into. So I got back and I had a pack of cigarettes with me and I sat there and I didn't really want to talk to anybody. And I sat there and I think I smoked a pack of cigarettes by myself and I could feel a change in me. Nothing that, you know, prevented me from doing my job, but something changed. You see something like that and I was just numb or cold. And somewhat emotionless to it at that time, which was, I mean, that's what happens is you're there. I mean, what are you going to do? Sit and cry and give up?
Now, you've told me that you have experienced symptoms of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about those symptoms?
It's the mindset of urgency. The combat mindset that you all, you know, are essentially hardwired for while you're there is that there's zero room for argument or, all right, give me just a second. It's, hey, do this, do it now, do it right, and move on. So it's, you know, you're impatient, you're everything needs to be done and done right, and if not, you know, it evokes a response of anger or anxiety, anger-type outbursts. I control it for the most part through a number of different ways, whether it's avoiding situations or meditation, deep breathing. I mean, I've before I even sought treatment, I used to try and do this and try to help myself.
And these self-care practices can in fact offer powerful tools for soothing anxiety and relieving other post-trauma symptoms. But to enhance his recovery, Kyle took another step and decided to seek support through counseling. He now urges other vets to consider that resource because providers are trained to help returning soldiers transition to life after combat.
My biggest issue is cognitive abilities. My memory's gotten really bad. My ability to focus, remember, concentrate have essentially diminished to the point where if I try to read a book or a magazine article, I'll get 10 pages into it and realize that I didn't take in a single word because my mind is going and it's working on 10 different things. You know, it essentially just never stops. Paranoia, the large crowds, you know, and that's tapered off. Again, that goes back to the combat mindset. Like, it's an insecure area to you. There's people in back of you, which makes me uneasy. More when I first got back, I would always choose the seat that where I could have the best view of the room with my back secure. It's drilled into you that that's, you know.
And you're talking about civilian settings, restaurants.
Restaurants, you name it. Crowded malls, and it made going out with my family and my kids very difficult to the point where I just didn't want to do it anymore.
Didn't want to go out?
I didn't want to go out. No. I remember the day that I moved to New Hampshire, it was Pumpkin Festival in Keene. So about a year after I got back, shoulder to shoulder people, and my heart was just racing. You know, I have my kids, and you try like hell to enjoy it, but all you feel is like, you know, there's a threat somewhere. So I got a kid on my shoulder. I got a kid that I'm holding tight to, and I'm telling my wife, like, hey, you know, keep them close by. And that was usually the issue. You know, anything that we did.
Has this harmed family relationships?
It has. I'm in the midst of a divorce right now. And I think, you know, some of the anger outbursts or the just inability to talk or, you know, it certainly played a factor.
Listening to Healing the Trauma of War, a documentary from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. To learn more about this special project, The Power of Nonviolence, to obtain audio copies or downloads of the series, and to hear more on how people can mend from post-traumatic stress, please visit humanmedia.org. The post-traumatic stress reaction to war has gone by various names through history. In the Civil War, the afflicted were said to have developed soldier's heart. World War I combatants might suffer from shell shock. And soldiers carrying these invisible wounds home from Vietnam a generation ago sometimes faced an added burden.
I didn't feel good about what I did there, and I didn't feel good about the whole thing. It was just a bad experience for me.
Bill Simon, now living in Santa Rosa, California, was an aircraft crew chief based in Da Nang, Vietnam, starting in 1969.
So, I knew that other people didn't like Vietnam veterans, and I didn't like myself for being a Vietnam veteran.
double punishment.
Exactly. So my strategy was to basically repress that whole thing, like it never happened. It obviously didn't work. It doesn't work to do that. But that's the way I got by as best I could, with the help of drugs and alcohol and a lot of other distractions.
Another Vietnam-era vet who battled addiction, Jim Summers of Solana Beach, California, served in the U.S. Navy Hospital Corps in the mid-70s.
When I got out of the military, I did what so many of us do. I put all that in a box along with my sailor hat and my dog tags and stuck it in the back of the closet and did the best I could to forget about it. But the Navy was also the place where my alcoholism got real serious. I was having a hard time living with what I was doing and had lots of unaddressed trauma issues. So I continued to numb myself for a number of years, and my life fell apart, as it so often does for people like that. And then when we invaded Iraq in 2002, and I became active in Veterans for Peace, I'm a founding member of the chapter in San Diego, that box came open, and there were things in there that I didn't remember I'd put there. And so I've had to deal with that as I've moved along.
I felt very isolated and not present. In the sense of being there emotionally, being there spiritually.
Kind of detached?
Very detached, right, from others and from myself. And I got that feedback from people. People would say, you know, it's like you're not here. You know, what's going on? Depression, a lot of depression, suicidal ideation. I never tried to kill myself, but I certainly thought about it on a daily basis for a long time.
Daily basis.
Sure, yeah. I would just have images of it. I didn't get to the point where I was making a real clear plan on how to do it, but it would just come into my head. I should take myself out. You know, I wasn't happy.
And especially if you're working against war or something like this, it's a challenge to put your face up against something that is so ugly. Constantly. And it's a challenge not to be depressed or angry. And I'm not the kind of guy that gets suicidal. I'm the kind of guy that gets homicidal. As a young man, I frequently went armed. 45 on the seat of my truck, or a buck knife on my belt, or worse. And I have given that up long since. I'm a violent man at my core. I know this about myself. I've done a lot to ease that, but I know that I have this capacity. I don't really have many good choices except to be a pacifist.
Maybe 18 was too early, maybe 30 or 40 is too. You get your chance to make peace with the man before he sent down his angel.
Travis Weiner of Boulder, Colorado, served two tours in infantry regiment, which performed counterinsurgency operations in Iraq between 2005 and 2008.
And 1 week into being there, we had a mass casualty. The insurgents landed a couple, I can't remember if it was 60s or 81s, into our courtyard and our patrol base, blew up like 30 of us. And this kid, it took a bunch of shrapnel on the legs, but, you know, he wasn't going to bleed out. He was okay. He recuperated for about a week. He said, you know, I can't go back out there. I'm scared and I have nightmares, et cetera, et cetera. To a person, all of us were like, you know, that kid is just, you know, getting out of it, yada, yada. We didn't understand the science of it. And what the science tells us is that, you know, we don't know that kid's life history. And we don't know how his brain works. And for him, that one mortar getting hit, which for us was one of many, I mean, we got blown up before, we got blown up after. For him, that could have been, you know, devastating.
Travis says he's managed to hang on through his supportive family and a physician at the VA who counseled him to cultivate self-acceptance as a way to ease his transition back to civilian life. Travis also made a commitment as part of that transition to help Iraqi refugees who are on their own healing journey.
It got better for me about 6 months in, and working with Veterans for Peace and trying to channel some of my anger and understand that I didn't hate, you know, the Iraqi people. You know, for years I just hated it was like battery acid, the Iraqis, because at least in my first tour, you know, it's insurgency. I mean, they pick you off, you know, they can't fight you in the open. So they just pick us off, and, you know, it was one, you know, a handful of times, if that, that we actually got to see them and fight them. And so you just, you know, it drives you insane. And, but letting go of that anger, working with the Iraqi refugees in Massachusetts, it was cathartic for me. It helped a tremendous deal.
Army band bugler plays taps on a snowy day at Arlington National Cemetery. Recovery from the emotional scars of war is rarely achieved acting alone. Many returned soldiers need the comradeship of fellow veterans who understand from direct experience the special challenges, the pain, the loneliness, and in some cases the shame carried by surviving combatants. Theologian Rita Nakashima Brock.
It's a kind of emotional solitary confinement where you can't connect to anybody because some of the deepest places in yourself are shut down and isolated in your afraid that they won't love you if they know what those are.
How can they move to a place of a feeling of greater connection?
I think the first step is for someone they can trust to be a trustworthy friend. And that's generally another veteran, but not always. And once they have at least one relationship of trust. In the military, it's often a chaplain, interestingly enough, because the chaplains are the only ones who can keep a confidence. Not, a clinician has to report a diagnosis, but a chaplain doesn't make a diagnosis. They just talk to people. And I think good chaplains can be that first place of processing and trust. And a good chaplain will listen to the suffering and help the person process it.
You're trying to get down at the deep disturbances in the psychological and the spiritual areas that the trauma caused.
Physician Wayne Jonas provides whole person care to veterans at Army clinics.
You have to say, I don't know everything about why this has happened to me, but I believe that there is the ability to have a positive, caring, nurturing, loving response come out of this. And if I believe that, then I begin to look for it and I can begin to see it. And that can guide me to a place that helps me become more peaceful, less angry, less reactive in those areas. Now, I may have to go through a lot of anger to get to that spot, and that's okay. But you need to go beyond yourself and realize that there are caring social support individuals that are here that love you and that will be on that journey with you.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart Rose. Editorial assistance from David Cruz, Ken Rogers, Kathy Graham, and Mark Kilstein. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Jason Isbell and Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN.
That's 1-800-5-LIS-TEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe at iTunes to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio. This segment, Healing the Trauma of War, part of our project, The Power of Nonviolence, is Humankind program number 248.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
What up, Bill Detroit? I'm Senior Chief Deontay Wade, United States Navy, supporting American diplomacy at the U.S. Embassy in Singapore. I would like to thank all the veterans in Detroit and across America. We salute you, thank you for your service, and defend your freedom around the world. Stay safe, and God bless.
We will never fully understand what we've asked of our military service members, of their families, or their children, asking them to deploy, patrol, stay on watch, on point, asking them to put themselves in harm's way, to endure it all. But we do understand that it's our turn, our duty, to bring them all the way home, to keep them secure, to have their backs for the rest of their lives. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs do whatever it takes to help our most severely ill or injured veterans live independently, at no cost, for life, so that they might stand at ease. Find out how you can help at findwwp.org.
This Humankind special project, The Power of Nonviolence, is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by a major grant from the Henry Luce Foundation.
I'm devastated with it. I can't stand what I participated in, what I did personally. And I say, okay, so where do we go from here? Is my life over? Do we keep going? And what can I do to make it better?
Veterans reconcile their own moral conscience with what they witnessed and did in war. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Decisions about war and peace churn up complicated moral questions, especially for soldiers. They bear the heavy burden of carrying out orders that can determine who lives or dies. Theologian Rita Nakashima Brock, based in Fort Worth, Texas, comes from a military family and has studied how soldiers work through conflicts about their military service.
I have a person I've talked to who was an Air Force pilot who served during the Cold War. He wasn't in any hot war. He never actually dropped any bombs on people. But he was in during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was a B-52 bomber pilot. So for an entire month during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the entire B-52 fleet was in the air fully loaded with nuclear weapons.
President John F. Kennedy, in an address from the White House, October 22, 1962.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
And so he flew around for a month waiting for DEFCON 1. We were at DEFCON 2. He was flying around thinking he's going to have to blow up Russia, and his family and his country might not be there when he got home, if he survived. 40 years later, he is experiencing an enormous amount of anguish about who he was at 23. That he was reading books on God and evil and all kinds of things, trying to figure it out.
The Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 induced an existential crisis. For the first time, the world confronted a real possibility that the United States and Soviet Union would unleash their terrifying arsenals of nuclear Armageddon. And sometimes the actions of soldiers in war produce immediate tragedy. In the Vietnam War, Bill Simon served on an American aircraft in 1969 and 70. He still wrestles with what happened one day.
I received some treatment for this. When you go through that, they ask you to pick the most painful event to focus on, so I've picked this event. And what happened was we took off from July, then we were going to Da Nang for maintenance on the aircraft, so I was with the aircraft. But we were just flying, and we passed this garden. There were a young Vietnamese man and probably his wife, I don't know, and their two kids. Two kids looked like they were probably under the age of seven. And they were in the garden just doing their own thing, and they weren't even concerned about us. We flew over fairly low. They didn't even look up. They just kept hoeing and doing what they were doing. And about 15 minutes later, we get a call. This guy is a bomber, and he had a loaded bomber, and he wanted to drop his ordnance somewhere, didn't want to take it back. Suddenly, the pilot thinks, yeah, we have a target for you. And he called in a bombing for that garden where those people were. He called it in, we got out of the way. Bombs were dropped, we came back, and we basically just, you know, kind of vaporized them. You couldn't even see what was there, this big holes. And that was really disturbing for me to see. And I completely denied that for 40 years, probably. This is fairly recent that I did this type of therapy. And when I did the therapy, I kept remembering more and more details of the event, which I had completely repressed.
Because at some level, what happened with that young family
was very disturbing for me, yeah. But I couldn't deal with it. I just had to, deny it and go numb.
When I was a young man, I was sent to a far-off country to fight a war I still don't understand. I was proud to go to serve for my country in the place they call South Vietnam.
The experience of deep regret for actions taken in war has come to be known as moral injury when soldiers participate in activity that violates their conscience. In her book, Soul Repair, Recovering from Moral Injury, Rita Nakashima Brock, who teaches at Bright Divinity School, tells of many veterans who are tormented by the violence they saw and sometimes perpetrated.
Some people can kill under orders and come to terms with that as what they did their job, and they can integrate that as then they may not feel very good about it, but they did what they were asked to do. Other people respond by feeling like that some line that made them a moral person was crossed, and they no longer feel like they're good. Just being capable of killing someone or doing something that crosses a major moral boundary. I'm not talking about kind of normal things we sort of feel guilty about and we go and apologize, but things that are huge taboos in a culture. Killing in most civilian cultures is regarded as criminal activity. It makes you a bad person. So when you're regularly exposed to those kind of alternative conditions where you're trained to do it, I mean, it isn't that they suddenly wind up killing without any preparation, and the military training is quite efficient and good at that. And in fact, they're taught to shoot without thinking about it because if you think, you're too slow. But that doesn't mean you don't think about it afterward.
If you think you're too slow.
Yes. Thinking slows down behavior.
Is that one of the purposes of thinking?
Yeah. Oh, yes. So you can talk to like a very well-trained athlete, and their training is such that they learn to do things without thinking, because if you have to think, can I make this turn on the ski run, you've already missed the turn. So your body just knows what to do, your whole body system, your senses and your muscles, from repeat training. And that's how they train troops to shoot. They train them to shoot on reflex. It's called reflexive fire training. And it can be life-saving if you don't. If you're stopping to think about whether you should or should not shoot in a situation where you're under fire, you may get yourself killed, or you may feel worse because your friend died and you didn't act fast enough. You can throw people into hell, into horrible, horrible things that wreck people. And their moral consciences won't let them go. That they still are capable of feeling terrible about it instead of just saying, well, oh, well, no big deal. That, to me, that's a presence of a humanity in a person that is indestructible.
And that suggests to me the way out of this trap.
Exactly. The only person who can't have moral injury is a sociopath.
Some soldiers accept horrible incidents as the unavoidably high human cost of military conflict. Others, on coming face to face with atrocities, resolve to oppose warfare because the price it exacts is too great.
It is a crisis of faith, and that's one of the hard parts of moral injury, is your whole meaning system can collapse.
And questions of morality and meaning, of responsibility for my own actions in this universe, are hard for anyone, especially young soldiers mostly trying to stay alive.
It's my opinion. I have many of them, but I think the term that there are no atheists in the foxholes is one of the stupidest things ever said in the history of the world.
Travis Weiner, who served in the U.S. 101st Airborne Infantry Regiment in Iraq.
In a way, that means that when I got blown up and lived, and someone else got blown up or shot and died, it was in some way, somehow supposed to happen. I just can't accept that. You know, I got a piece of metal in my neck in between my spine from a mortar that, you know, the docs told me it's tiny and it's small and you're totally fine. You know, fraction of a millimeter up, down, left, or right, could have been paralyzed. Is that just pure mathematical chance, or is that supposed to happen? I mean, it's, you know.
How do you approach that question?
The way I approach it is I say to myself, okay, if all of this is total randomness and zeros and ones and who lives and who dies, that emotionally the reaction for people, and this ties back to religion and larger society, is it's almost incapacitating. It's so devastating and so terrible, you know, the whole like nothing after we die thing, that most people just can't accept it. And I have the same reaction everybody else does, but then when I don't stop there, I say, okay, I'm having that reaction, but does that make it true? It's war. I mean, it's some people get hit, some people don't. It's math, it's numbers. That's it. That's all it is. And look, I respect all veterans, and there are some combat veterans face way worse than I do, have a totally different opinion. You know, and I respect that.
It raises all kinds of questions about God and evil. If God is a benevolent God and is all-powerful, how can these terrible things happen?
Theologian Rita Nakashima Brock.
I mean, that's a classic framing in theology, when you have an all-powerful God who's supposed to also be loving. And then you pray that your best friend isn't going to die and they get shot and killed. Or you accidentally kill somebody on your own side. Your faith in that power of goodness can collapse completely, and your faith in your own goodness.
Part of your faith is that you hope, you know, God's never going to give you more than you can handle on your own.
Kyle of the New Hampshire National Guard, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And if he does, he's there with you. I mean, everybody's seen the posters, you know, look back and there's two sets of footsteps, because I was always there with you. But it's true. I mean, if you feel that you're alone outside of your, you know, normal relationships with other people, and then all you have to rely on is that, I mean, you got to just got to relinquish yourself to it. You've got to say that, hey, you know, I've made it this far. Somebody's either helping me carry the load, or they thought I could handle it.
And when you feel moments of being overwhelmed by the burden, by the memories, by the residual reactions, are you able to release it to a higher power?
Sometimes it's easier than others, but yeah, I can. I have. You just have to reach the point where you say, me worrying about this, I can't have an effect on this. I'm not going to let it consume me. And that's when you just have to say that this one's on God. It's going to come out. He's got a plan for it. Stand by.
And does that noticeably lighten the burden?
Sometimes it's easier to digest than others, but sometimes you gotta fake it till you make it and remind yourself and keep saying it and reinforce that fact to yourself. There's a plan. And you're not alone.
You're listening to The Power of Nonviolence, a special project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. To learn more about this documentary, Healing the Trauma of War, to obtain audio copies or downloads of our series, and to hear more on moral injury, please visit humanmedia.org. The human being is deeply shaken by viewing extreme violence and its effects. Most of us would be unprepared for the emotional aftershocks. The kind of brutality witnessed in a war zone seems to cut to a person's core. Manny Salazar, a former policeman now living in Washington, served in Iraq and later at an American tactical base in Helmand, Afghanistan, where he was a counterintelligence agent. He returned to the States in 2015 and is coping with PTSD.
I got back and I still dealt with it. I didn't talk to anyone for a good 2.5-3 months. I was suffering with the migraines as a result of PTSD and a sleep deprivation. And
migraines can be paralyzing.
Absolutely. I mean, look where I'm at. I've left a 4,000 square foot home to come live in looks like a shelter / war room. I got vision boards. I've got my surveillance system set up, so I'm still very much in deployment mode, but I'm working through these things step by step. I was struggling to get back to the person that everyone knew me as I was, both in my civilian career and my military career. I don't know how many times I went up to the VA on the third floor and looked at the mental health services and walked there and then walked right back out. In fact, I had scheduled several appointments and never showed up. Because at that point, for me, what I was thinking was, once I cross this ledge, it's done. My career's over. And I very much wanted to be in the fight.
What I'm hearing is that you were in a fight right then and there.
Oh, I was definitely in a fight. And, you know, I knew it. I was staying up all night. I was not talking to my kids, my family. I wasn't calling back my, you know, folks that I talked to. I was isolating myself.
Now living alone, Manny sometimes gets together with other veterans who've come back. They celebrate having survived. But Manny continues to struggle with haunting memories from the tough scenes he saw in Afghanistan, including fellow soldiers who died before his eyes. And he recalls interactions with some of the civilians.
Relationships that I had built out in town, folks that I trusted, Afghan locals that I trusted, that I worked with, would come and ask me, you know, I had a child that was burned, 6-month-old child that was burned, come to the gate and needed some help. And we couldn't provide the help. I had to turn her away, even though I knew they had a staff fully capable of providing some kind of aid. At the time, the medical rules of engagement did not allow us to care for and take care of kids, even though I know everyone wanted to do it. But those rules were set up and we had to follow them.
And this shows another kind of moral injury, not from perpetrating an action that violates conscience, but from a soldier's regret at being unable to prevent one.
It is among the last things they will talk about.
Reverend Carol Ramsey Lucas is a member of the chaplain service at the VA Medical Center in Washington, D.C.
Sometimes veterans will circle around a whole lot of care for very specific physical reasons, and they have plenty of traumatic situations to talk about, but they'll avoid this one, this where they did something or didn't stop something from happening or witnessed something. But really, that's the core of all the physical symptoms, and they circle around it for a long time.
Because it's so painful?
It's so painful. It's guilt and shame, feeling of disconnect from God.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You go in and you're watching some of the worst horrors that are known, and you ask yourself, you know, if there's a God out there, how can he allow this stuff to happen?
Don't pick it up.
In the film American Sniper, a young boy in Iraq struggles to pick up a heavy rocket launcher from the street. An American soldier perched on a nearby rooftop spots the boy through the scope of his powerful rifle, fearing he may have to shoot the child.
People are blowing up trucks, or children are coming at you with bombs, and there's a question of having to act quickly. You know, is this person coming at me to take this, to steal a car, or are they coming at me with a bomb? And so veterans are making decisions about who lives and who dies.
You mean like, do I shoot that child?
Right.
And how does somebody make that decision?
Sometimes very quickly. And I think that's part of the issue, is that in combat, things move very fast, very quickly, and decisions are made, and it all makes sense in that context because the line of decision-making is very different. Who tells who what to do is different. And then when you get home and you look back and like, who am I, that person who decided this other person needed to die?
There's red, white, and blue in the rafters. And there's silent old men from the Corps. What did they say when they shipped you away to fight somebody's Hollywood war? Nobody could forget you. You showed us what we had to lose.
Veteran Manny Salazar in Washington.
I'm at Walter Reed. I volunteer and I do a lot of outreach, and you look at some of these folks, these amputees and these guys struggling, and the amount of veterans that commit suicide on a daily basis, and you ask yourself, if there's a God out there, how can you allow this type of suffering?
The question that pervades so much anguish in our world. And even in the face of man's inhumanity to man, people of faith draw strength and solace from a higher power. But reacting to tragedy can be complicated.
A lot of anger sometimes, a lot of wrestling.
Reverend Cheryl Jones, also with the VA Chaplain Service in Washington.
So I always believe that God is right there with us in the suffering, weeping with us, carrying us through, trying to lead us through, but that God is with us wherever we are. So, yes, I get angry, I get upset. You'll hear stories that'll break your heart, and my heart is broken many times. But then I have to heal, and I've healed through not only exercise and yoga, but talking to my colleagues, writing about it, doing music about it. But I always believe God is with us in the suffering. And God is the one that is helping us make meaning of it. You know, I turn to scriptures, all through the Psalms, those lament Psalms, where are you, God? You know, I find comfort in that somebody else is asking these same questions. I'm not alone with these questions. I haven't given up that, you know, there is no God. I haven't gone to that.
But even for the most fervent believers, a layer of mystery always surrounds the presence of God. Perhaps the divine can be found in little things, simple human gestures of kindness that can comfort others in distress, and self-mercy that can help us come to peace ourselves. Daniel Libby is a readjustment counselor at the Oakland, California Vet Center and executive director of the Veterans Yoga Project.
If you feel like you're this horrible person, you know, I've worked with a lot of men and women who, you know, they're not terrible people. They're not horrible people, right? Even some of the men and women that I've worked with who have done some horrible things, right, they're not horrible people, yet they feel like horrible people. But they're not horrible people because what do they do is they isolate themselves. Part of the reason they isolate themselves is because they don't want to hurt anybody else, right? Really, which to me reveals like that they're not horrible people because they really don't want to harm anybody else.
But counselors emphasize that recovery lies in being available for connection, in opening up and reaching out.
One patient I'm thinking about in particular that I was working with recently, that was sort of his way. He can sit with it if he brings God into it, right, and lets God, you know, hold it with him.
He can sit with it.
He can sit with the pain.
So he needn't flee or push back at that moment.
Right, right. And so instead of like having this pain, you know, this sort of anxiety, and instead he's going to go home and isolate himself. Now maybe he can use that and still come to an event and still connect with other people. You can have that painful, you know, memory and still continue to live in line with your values and goals.
I'm thinking of my heritage, my African-American heritage, and the struggles, the suffering, the stories, the experiences.
Reverend Cheryl Jones.
And I believe that, you know, there is a higher calling. There is a spirit that has been, and a spiritual entity that has been with that struggle, with my heritage. You know, they say African people do not doubt the existence of God. Now, we certainly have had horrible experiences on this side of Earth, but still, that spiritual entity, I believe, lives within me and has guided us to this point. I just strongly believe. Now, you know, what to call it sometimes, is it? Is it of the Christian faith? Is it of, you know, these particular religions? Is that all? No, I don't believe that's all. I love the stories of Jesus, but I respect other stories and other faiths and other spiritual leanings. So, but the presence of a spirit, of a guiding force, a higher power, I don't think I've ever doubted that.
You know, I'm devastated with it. I can't stand what I participated in, what I did personally, what I largely participated in. I say, okay, so where do we go from here?
Iraq veteran Travis Weiner.
Is my life over? Do we keep going? And what can I do to make it better? You know, I'm going to help other vets. I'm going to help, you know, Iraqi, you know, refugees. I'm going to speak truth to power. And is it going to prevent, speak truth about the wars? Is it going to prevent the next one? Probably not. But at least you tried. At some point, of course, with ISIS and everything going on, I want to go back there and do some humanitarian work.
What would that look like?
I want to farm over there. You know, one thing I always think about, all the houses we hit, every, you know, villager, largely, a lot of them are subsistence farmers. They have cows, donkeys, and they have crops, and they farm, and they're dirt poor, and that's what they do. And every time we got intelligence about, you know, supposedly this insurgent lived here, we would just land, you know, Chinooks or Blackhawks and just trample their entire farm fields, kill their crops. You know, certainly not going to, you know, the brass is not going to not do it. Just be, you know, who cares about their crops? You know, this is war, blah, blah, blah. But what does that do, you know, to them? What does that do to the larger hearts and minds, you know? And I just think about that. My mom's actually a farmer, and I used to, she's a small farmer, organic farmer. I used to help her on the farm growing up, and, when I was, you know, in college and everything, and I used to just think, you know, again, there's absolutely nothing to stop an alternative scenario of that being my mom and it being her village and, you know, come and put her in zip cuffs and trample her farm field. Why? Because that country's there and we're here and we're more powerful and they're not. It's all the same.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart-Rose. Editorial assistance from David Cruz, Ken Rogers, Kathy Graham, and Mark Kilstein. Webmaster, Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Tony Buck and to HCI for permission to use Delmer Presley's song, Where Were You?, part of the book 30 Days with My Father by Crystal Presley. The program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. And our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe at iTunes to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio. This segment, Moral Injury, part of our project, The Power of Nonviolence, is Humankind program number 249.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
What would you give for a child you loved to make their wish come true? To help them fight a critical illness? Just imagine what you'd do. You see, wishes are so powerful, and you can make them real. They can give a child back their childhood, even change the way they feel. Every single one of us can make the stars align, because when we come together, hope and joy will shine. Wishes need stars like you. Visit Make-A-Wish at wish.org.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported non-commercial radio.
Stay. When I leave the big cities,